Hi, I'm Sherry Johnson, and you are about to discover how to embrace your life as a childless woman who wanted to have a family and never could. This is where we combine mindset shifting tools with practical tips so you can break free of outdated societal norms that condition us all to believe that women without kids just don't measure up to the moms. It's where we take action on processing grief and accelerating the healing journey so you can feel free. When childless women awaken their self-worth, they transform from hopeless and inadequate to worthy, accepting, and purposeful. Think of this podcast as your weekly dose of light bulb moments that will shift your perspective as a childless woman about yourself, about your innate power to change yourself, your future, and maybe even the world we live in. If that's what you want, then keep on listening. Welcome back to the Awakening Worth podcast. I am really excited to have one of my previous guests back with me today, Jodi Day. I interviewed her about just over a year ago, and we had so much to talk about that I just had to have her back as I start my new season here. We're about 6 or 7 episodes in here. And I'm going to ask Jodi to do a quick introduction of her, but if you want the full recap, go back to the episode with her from about a year ago. I'm going to link that up in the show notes. I can't remember the number of it at the moment. But Jodi, I want to welcome you back to the show. I'm really excited. Our last conversation was so eye-opening for me that I can't wait to find out what's up on today's show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me back. And sharing this with your listeners again. It's a real pleasure to be back. Yeah, it was a great conversation, very well received by sort of my audience as well. So I'm sure they'll be very happy to hear from you again.
Oh, thank you. Yes, also well received from my audience. It's a real pleasure to have you back. So why don't you, for those who didn't hear the first episode and may not know you, maybe start with a little bit about your story and then we'll dive into the deep stuff.
Okay, well, so my name's Jodi Day. I'm the founder of Gateway Women, which is a global advocacy and support network for women who are childless, not by choice. I'm a psychotherapist and the author of Living the Life Unexpected, How to Find Hope, Meaning, and a Fulfilling Future Without Children. I live in rural Ireland. I don't have any kids and I have a dog. And so that's kind of who I am. And I think one of the most important things now is I'm someone who's also aging without children. I will be 60 next year. In 2014, I was one of 4 kind of campaigners who started something in the UK called Aging Without Children, which I'm no longer involved with, but still very, you know, very supportive of. That's gone on to become a charity in the UK. And I think in COVID, it became incredibly, incredibly clear how vulnerable people aging without children can be, not having familial support around them when things, you know, when things happen in life. An awful lot of people are also aging without partners as well as without children. And that isolation, it not only can be difficult to deal with, it can also be quite dangerous. And our society is sleepwalking around the issue of people aging without children. So that's kind of where my attention is these days.
Yes. And it's also one of the things that I hear our community talk about the most. Who will take care of me when I get
It's interesting.
Old?
I think I was on a call earlier today because I'm leading a panel discussion on this later this month. And so I was pre-meeting with the panel. I was saying that I remember that when I realized I was definitely not going to be a mother, I was 44 and a half. And literally almost the next thought that I had, having never had this thought ever in my entire life, once I knew I was definitely not going to be having children, I thought, who's going to be there for me when I'm old? Mm-hmm. It was like the next thought. And because I've worked with thousands of women, you know, through Gateway Women, I know it's really, really common that becomes suddenly a huge worry that just heaves into focus out of nowhere. It's like you've never thought about this before, but suddenly it's like, oh my goodness, how am I going to cope with that? And it was really interesting because when I was involved with Aging Without Children, I remember, we'd be talking to parents about this issue and they'd say, but I didn't have my children so they could look after me when I'm old. And I went, yeah, I'm sure you didn't. All the time I was trying to conceive, it's not a thought that ever came into my head. You know, mm-hmm. I said, so it's great that you don't want that. I'd just be really interested to know what plans you're putting into place so that that doesn't happen.
Right.
All I would get is crickets, because actually they weren't putting any plans into place, because unconsciously they are relying on the fact that they have children, and we can't do that. So it just comes right up in our face, and then it's like, okay, I need to do something about this. And then it's like, but what?
Right.
What do I do? And it's really challenging. And it actually immobilizes a lot of people who become so scared of it that they do nothing.
Right.
You know, that's a big focus of the next decade of my work. It's like, probably the worst thing you can do is nothing.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I think aging is such a scary thing anyway for people. It's, you know, the fear of death, the fear of becoming sick, the fear of becoming irrelevant. There's so many fears associated with becoming older and aging already. We don't want to talk about wills. For me, as a child of aging parents, you know, we haven't had a discussion about what do they want? Where do I find your passwords to things? You know, simple things about how are we going to care for you when you can't take care of yourself, and then after you have left this earth, they don't want to talk about it. I think it's quite an epidemic in our society that it's not just childless people that are afraid of what happens when we get older. It's also the people who have children. They are just, it's just unconscious for them.
Well, I mean, we live in a profoundly ageist society that focuses on youth as being the kind of the peak of life, that the aging is nothing but decline, that there is absolutely nothing to look forward to, nothing special about it. You just become irrelevant, invisible, you know, maybe even incontinent. It's like there is nothing to look forward to about it. And that is absolutely not true. I think probably the biggest challenge about thinking about elderhood is that none of us know what our health is going to be like. It's a really, really hard thing to plan for, because we don't know what our needs might be. But once again, making no plan, you know, the thing is to, there are some things we have agency around, and those are the things we need to be thinking about. And as you say, like with your parents, talking about. And it's, I mean, 50% of people in the UK and the USA do not have a will. That is how many people are convinced they're not going to die. And yet, you know, it leaves the most incredibly painful mess for those people who are tasked with kind of dealing with the admin, or rather what we call the sadmin, that goes after they die, because we don't know what their wishes are.
Right.
And as you say, we don't know where the passports are. We don't know where the passwords are. We have no, you know, legal right to sort out their financial affairs. So at a time when, you know, we are perhaps dealing with the, you know, the emotional and psychological issues around that person's death, we're also faced with huge legal bills and a lot of uncertainty and a lot of extra stress that doesn't need to be there. Because the thing about making a will, and I do have a will, it is confronting to do it, but it was very relieving to have done it. I did it when I was 50, a bit late, but I got there, is that someone told me something really useful, is that a will only has to cover what would happen if you died tomorrow. It doesn't have to cover every possible eventuality that might happen between now and death, just tomorrow.
Right.
And it doesn't have to list everything that has to do with, you know, your books, your possessions, your vases, your dog, none of that, you know, that can all go in a separate letter. Like in the UK, it's called a letter of wishes. It's called something different in different countries. And you can keep updating that. You know, it can be a document like a Google Doc on your computer, and you can just keep updating that. So as things change, you know, you can change that, as long as your executors know how to get hold of that letter. You know, they need the password to that document. There's a lot of really straightforward things you can do, but this overwhelming fear, and it is a fear of death in the human consciousness, really, really gets in the way. Now, there is something fascinating called terror management theory. Now, terror management theory is a psychological mechanism which describes how human beings manage being, as far as we know, the only sentient species that knows it's going to die. Now, if we were aware of that every minute of our waking life, it would immobilize us. So actually, we have all of these really, really clever mechanisms to make sure we're not thinking about it. You add ageism to that, and sexism and pronatalism and all kinds of other things, and you just get this enormous disincentive to think about death and to think about your own death. And actually, most childless women that I talk to are not actually afraid of death. I mean, not that anyone's like really looking forward to it. They're actually afraid of vulnerability and dependency.
Yes.
And not having someone trusted to help during that period that they already know who it's going to be. That's the bit that scares them.
You're so right. I don't feel afraid of death. I've talked about this a lot through the last 3 years. Why I felt so differently than some of the people around me about the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't actually think I am afraid of death. I'm afraid of pain leading up to it.
Yeah. Yep.
I'm afraid of that vulnerability. But I also am in this position where I'm a nutritionist. Mm-hmm. I spend a lot of time taking care of my health. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is unconsciously driven by that need to not be vulnerable when I'm older, but I never even thought about that until this moment. But mm-hmm. I spend a lot of time taking care of myself, and I know that I am not going to get sick anytime soon, unless it's something mm-hmm. completely out of nowhere. But my body, my emotional, my spiritual health are in a really good place. So mm-hmm. that's really fascinating.
Well, that's something we can do. You know, as you say, illnesses that are not lifestyle related mm-hmm. can still happen. We can't predict those. And I think it's not even the illness itself. It's the management of that illness and the management of any vulnerabilities that may come out of it that can be really challenging to think through, particularly if you're also single or living alone. You know, just simple things like having a hospital appointment and them saying, well, who's going to come and collect you? Or you can't go home on your own, or you need someone to monitor your meds or something like that. And it's like, well, there is no one. And what I'm hearing from people is that hospitals still think that's an aberration, when in actual fact, you know, we've got currently 1 in 5 people, you know, don't have kids, about 1 in 4 men, 1 in 5 mm-hmm. women. That's going to go up massively with the next generation. We could be looking at 1 in 4 or even 1 in 3. And so the idea that, you know, is already an awful lot of people older than us as well. You know, people in their 60s and 70s, there are a lot of people aging without children, whether they chose to be childless or childlessness chose them. And also people who are estranged from their children, whose children live on the other side of the world, whose children have predeceased them or have care needs of their own. There are many reasons why someone might be vulnerable in older age and not have that absolute plug and play family situation to sort it out. But the medical profession and the governments of our countries are absolutely sticking their fingers in their ears around this.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And there is nothing in place,
nothing
to help that. And if it leads to another discussion, which is around financial health, right? Because the position that we're left in as childless women is, and especially if you're single, is you need to be financially stable, and even more so to be able to pay for care if you don't have children.
I think it's been shown that single, older, childless women are actually some of the least financially resourced women. So actually, there's very, very few of them are going to be in a good financial position. And, you know, less and less of them will have property or savings, because the cost of living has gone through the roof. The wages have not kept pace with that. And so very few people have savings. And I think the millennial generation coming up, very few of them will have been able to afford property. So the idea that somehow, you know, we're going to have to fund care, the money just isn't there.
No, and I think that's also, you know, this is a little bit of a different topic, but there's this big myth out there that people who don't have children have all of this disposable income. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that that's the case.
I've been doing this for 15 years and I haven't met them.
No. And I had somebody write me an email about this when I started talking about the pronatalist policies of our government. you know, baby bonuses and all of the, you know, the fact that almost 20% of my finances, my income tax goes to funding education for other people's children. And as soon as I start talking about those things, then I have mothers come back to me and start talking about, well, we are so hard done by, it's so expensive to raise children. You must have so much more money than I do. So stop your complaining.
I don't think it's a very helpful response. I think parents do have it hard. I think it is really tough for them. And if they want to have a competition with me about how tough it is and they think theirs is tougher than mine, I'll say, maybe it is. I don't want to take away from your situation, but that doesn't mean that there aren't other people struggling in different ways.
Exactly.
It is incredibly expensive to do anything, and raising children is one of them. I mean, it might be that someone who, you know, has spent a lot of money on fertility treatments that haven't worked. It might be that they've had to take extended career breaks, you know, to cope with grief and their life falling apart in their 40s. There might be many reasons why they may not be as financially resourced as someone might imagine. And also, you know, they just may not have ever worked in a profession that provided the opportunity to build those kinds of resources. And particularly if you're also single, you know, being single over the lifetime, I mean, it was an article in The Atlantic, I quote it in my book, it's a bit out of date now, but they worked, you know, you can check the numbers on this, and it's in my book, that over the course of a lifetime, you know, being single, as in unmarried, is $1 million, $1 million American more expensive to be single than to be married. You know, so it's, people sometimes don't really stop to reflect on how different it might be to be single and childless, or even to be a childless couple compared to a married couple in terms of tax breaks. And as you say, those of us who don't have children pay a lot of our taxes towards those things that people with families rely on, like schools and hospitals. And we do so willingly as part of our role of citizens in a civic society. I have no problem with that. But what I do have a problem with is that at the end of our life, when perhaps we don't have family to care for us, there's nothing. And we're seen as somehow a drain on the system, as if we've never contributed anything. That is pronatalism speaking, by the way, because pronatalism says you are a worthless human being in reality because you haven't had children. You haven't contributed children to the system, so you haven't contributed anything. And I have to push back against that very, very hard, because actually childless people, and particularly single childless people and child-free, have been shown to be the biggest contributors to charities and to political campaigns, and they're the ones that do the most amount of voluntary work. You know, we do a lot to keep things going, and we do so willingly, and we do so without anyone noticing or saying, wow, well done.
It's so true. And when you talk about willingly, you know, it wasn't until women mothers started pushing back on me on the pronatalist policies of our government, that was when I actually started to look into it. I didn't even care. I had no clue how much of my taxes were going towards education or childcare bonuses and all of these other things. It didn't even cross my mind. And it was only when I was being challenged that I started to look into it. And I thought, you know, why am I even doing this? It doesn't matter. I'd never cared before. I don't care now. It's just, it is what it is, and how, you know, my taxes contribute to a functioning society.
But is it a functioning society if it doesn't care for its elders?
Well, no, it's not. You're absolutely right. It's a functioning society
for some people.
For some people.
And barely functioning for them. But it's, you know, there are so many people for whom our societies are not working. You know, those who've been systemically disadvantaged for a long time, there are an awful lot of people that it's not working for.
No, it's so true. I heard you talking about the, I think it was on a recent podcast, and you were quoting something about the Finnish government, who are actually doing something about it. I think it was on Spinsterhood Reimagined.
I think they are, I mean, they're trying to bring in, kind of making it easier for students to have children, to really basically try and make it easier for kind of grown-ups to have children when they're younger, to kind of rejig education and starting your career and things like that, which is something, you know, I mentioned in my book, because one of the difficulties of having children can often be that by the time you've got all of your sort of Western capitalist ducks in a row, you know, maybe it's too late to find a partner, or it's too late with that partner to have children easily. That's one thing. I mean, as part of me thinks, if we're all going to be living till we're 90, 100, if retirement is going to become as quaint an idea as sort of the Victorian idea of sending children up chimneys to clean them, you know, there will be no pensions, there will be no retirement, we'll all be working till we drop. Why do we have to try and get everything done in the first 30 years or the first 35 years? Why can't we kind of work with our biology better? I mean, I don't think those thoughts are welcome. They also, in a way, they're in themselves, they're actually slightly pronatalist, because it presumes that that's what everyone should be doing, is having kids. Mm-hmm. Which actually it isn't the case. I don't think it is something everyone should be doing. I think there are quite a lot of people out there who probably should have swerved and didn't. Yes. But also, although the economy may need us all to be having children, because the economy is a Ponzi scheme. Basically, it's like, you know, the taxation system and the pension systems rely on more and more, you know, 20-year-old people joining the workforce to pay for those people who are older. Now, I naively used to think that the taxes I were paying was going into some kind of pot somewhere. And that, you know, when I was an old person and perhaps I needed long-term care, there was a sort of a pot of money. But no, mm-hmm. what I came to understand is all of my taxes have been spent. They have been spent on supporting people who are older than me. You know, they have paid for the long-term care and healthcare and other things for people older than me, and also for, you know, children and people around me. But so my long-term care, should I need it, needs to be paid for by the taxes of people just joining the workforce now. Now, as there are many less of them, and with many less people having children for a wide variety of reasons, that means the next generation has less people to have children. So the kind of, you know, that the population will shrink over the next few generations, which means those young people coming into the workforce are faced with a really difficult situation. So everything's more expensive. They're going to be expected to pay even higher taxes to pay for the kind of the older people that need support, but there are less of them to pay it. And into an economy with no stability.
Yeah. You just said so much there. That was a real eye-opening moment for me, because I knew that my taxes were being spent on all of these other things. But the metaphor you used, it's not even a metaphor. It's the Ponzi scheme. I had never thought of it as a Ponzi scheme. And that is so true. And we have the Elon Musks of the world, the conservatives who want us to keep having more children because it's part of a healthy economy. And
it's more taxpayers and more consumers, more taxpayers.
Yeah. And it just, I see why, but I also see that there must be other solutions to that.
There are other solutions. They are less comfortable ones. I mean, we are, whether we like it or not, and mostly we don't like it, we're going to be moving into a period of economic degrowth, because the capitalist model is one that is based on endless growth. So, but we have now exceeded the resources of the planet. So the planet has put the brakes on. So we're going to be entering a period of degrowth. So shrinking economies, shrinking populations, shrinking living standards, shrinking tax base. These things are politically very, very difficult to manage. They often lead to revolutions. So it's going to be, yes, in a way it is going to be a difficult time, but we're actually not going to be presented with a choice because of the climate. So in a way, whether we like it or not, we are entering a period of degrowth. And that degrowth may bring us back to something which is much more in balance with what the planet can manage. But it's going to be a bumpy 100 years.
Quick interruption here to talk about creating your best year. We are just over 6 weeks into 2024. And if you haven't seen any improvement towards getting to your best year ever, even without kids, then you need to download my free guide on how to create it. You will discover what might be standing in the way of your best life. I've got 3 mistakes in there that you might be making that are keeping you stuck in grief, and how you can really tap into what you truly desire in your life. You can get that free guide by going to sherryjohnson.ca/bestyear. I will link that up in the bottom of the show notes so you don't have to worry about the spelling, but it's sherryjohnson.ca/bestyear. It's a free guide. It's going to help you to create your best 2024, a year full of purpose and meaning and joy. So go grab that now. And let's get back to the episode now. I think so too. And it all, gosh, what you're saying, it starts to, it's like every time we talk, Jody, I have all these, I talked about this last time, like these ideas all are floating around in my head and they're like little pieces. And then suddenly you've created the web that weaves them all together. And then they start to make sense. All of the interconnections between capitalism and colonialism and patriarchy and pronatalism, they all are part of the same web.
Yeah. And it's tightening. You know, that web is, it is both tightening, but it is also breaking, you know, and that's why I think sort of, you know, Ruby Warrington's work is so important. You know, she's really brought a feminist and a political lens to what it means to be a non-parent. You know, Ruby is childless by choice. She's child-free. We had such an interesting chat, she and I, because I didn't have a word for it, but I was child-free in my 20s. I was pretty sure I didn't want to have children after a very traumatic childhood. And once I was part of my first husband's loving family for a few years, I kind of changed my mind because I had a new idea of what family could mean. And, you know, Ruby said something to me. She said, you know, if I had had that experience, maybe I would have gone the other way. You know, she's just so brilliantly honest, Ruby. But she's, you know, she's child-free, I'm childless. But in many ways, our thinking is very aligned about what a political statement it is to be a woman without children and how politicized we are. Because I do believe that as that degrowth happens and the, you know, the impact of population sort of, you know, shrinking has on demographics, like, you know, in Japan, for example, you know, many, many primary schools and schools are closing because of the change in the population structure. You know, these are very emotive issues and people look for a scapegoat. And I have to say, they're going to come after childless women. I think women without children are really going to have to wake up to what a political statement we represent to the status quo. And whether we chose childlessness or childlessness chose up, I think, you know, I'm sorry, people like Elon Musk and other, you know, other big voices and big heads are going to blame us for the ills of the world, because everyone loves a scapegoat.
Yes, and they already do. I mean, they're already, there's the women who are speaking out and being chastised for it. There's the Chelsea Handlers and the Ruby Warringtons. They're all like, get back down in your box because you're saying stuff that we don't like.
Yeah. And I think I still have a role to play. Just, you know, I may not have children, but I still think, and particularly as I move into my elder years, I think, you know, I still have a lot to contribute. And, you know, maybe it's not someone who, in, you know, if I had children at 29, they would be in the workforce now and they'd be taxpayers. I haven't provided any taxpayers, but I do have other things to offer.
Yes. Well, and maybe things that our patriarchal leaders don't like. And, you know, I'm glad you brought up Ruby Warrington, because I love her work and I listened to your interview with her on her podcast.
Yeah.
And one of these days I'm going to get her over here on my podcast because it's now a year into my own, you know, let me step back for a second. You and probably Therese Schechter, I'm not sure if you know Therese, she's a documentary filmmaker and she was a guest on my podcast and she talked about pronatalism. I interviewed her just before you and I had never even heard that word before. Between you and her, you opened up this whole can of worms, really.
Sorry about that.
Well, and I had never thought of myself as a feminist for many reasons that women don't want to be known as a feminist because we're taught as young women that feminists are man haters. And I don't want to be one of those. So I never thought of myself as a feminist until I really had that conversation with you and Therese. And I started reading about it. And I read The Dance of the Dissident Daughter, which is a memoir by Sue Monk Kidd. It's fantastic. That's about her journey of awakening to the patriarchy within the church. And I grew up in a religious home and was also influenced by those same things. And what we were talking about before we hit record, that my childlessness became this catalyst to opening up my eyes and my heart to the patriarchy and its influences on me, pronatalism, which is a piece of that, and how that impacted me. And it's only now after that journey, I think that's why I found Ruby, because I was using those hashtags, child-free, patriarchy, pronatalism. I wanted to find people who were talking about it. And now it's like this voracious appetite that I have for learning more and wanting to open up more hearts and eyes to what we are so influenced by.
Yeah. Another book I would really recommend is, and it's the one that really opened my eyes to pronatalism back in 2012, and it's called The Baby Matrix, and it's by Laura Carroll. And she uses the metaphor of kind of like, you know, the red pill from the Matrix. And it really is like that, because when you have your eyes opened to patriarchy, to pronatalism, you can't unsee it. It's like you realize how incredibly insidious it is and how it influences so much about our beliefs about ourselves as women. And when we are women without children, our negative beliefs about ourselves as women. And, you know, that book was a very, very powerful awakening for me. And I would agree that actually I was single and childless for most of my 40s after my marriage broke down at the end of my 30s. And it was a reawakening for me. I had been a very feminist teenager, but I kind of went to sleep in my marriage. I think I made a deal with myself quite early on before we got married that if this was going to work, I had to sort of toe the line. You know, I really loved him. I really wanted to be with him. We were always fighting about things. I was a very, you know, very feisty young woman. And I just, you know, I was up against someone who was a higher class than me, who came from a kind of a really privileged British sort of upper class background, you know, with a big solid family and a big solid story about his history and portraits on the wall and all of this. I was kind of this scrappy little dog that kind of got in through the back door. And I just realized that my fierceness, my sense of independence, my sense of wanting my own voice and my own identity in everything and believing that that was right was somehow something I was going to have to give up if this relationship was going to work. And, you know, I made an unconscious deal with myself just to park that side of myself. And the moment I did that, the relationship worked, you know, and it wasn't until I had my nervous breakdown at 38, which kind of led 37, which led to, you know, led to the end of my marriage, along with my unexplained infertility and his own issues, that I kind of came out of this trance. And as I kind of picked myself up in my 40s, and I think my singleness was the thing that really, really showed me my feminism back. My singleness was like, I was persona non grata. You know, as a kind of single childless woman in my 40s, I swear the only invitation I would get would be to a dental checkup. It was like I dropped off the planet. You know, once I was no longer part of a couple and we'd been together for 16 years, we were like the first couple in our group to kind of get married. We were like a foundational couple in our sort of social group. And, you know, people were very, I mean, I was having a really hard time in the marriage. He had a lot of issues. People were saying, you know, you shouldn't be putting up with this, you know, blah, blah, you should leave him, you should do this. And actually when I did, everyone forgot about me. And, you know, to see how little, because I always thought that my social status belonged to me. And I got divorced and found that my social status belonged to us and actually to him. And that as a single woman, I had no social status at all. It was devastating. And yes, it was an awakening for me. And then that with my childlessness together and how people saw me as a lesser woman because I didn't have children, it just fired me up completely, you know. And yeah, I'm very grateful. Yes. I'm very grateful to, you know, to my single and childless 40s for bringing me back to the person I was before. And then also thank you menopause, which kind of took me back even further, because menopause, I think, has returned me to the kind of feisty, questioning, fierce, brave little girl I was before puberty. I'm just like, but why is it like that?
Right.
You know?
Well, and the more that I read about midlife and menopause, the more I believe that it is that there is a reason why the majority of divorces happen in their 40s, to women in their 40s. Yeah. This is when we, you know, a lot of women, their children are going off to school, mm-hmm. or if they are childless or child-free, they're speaking up. They start mm-hmm. to find the fire again. And Dr. Christian Northrup, another great book. She's written many.
I don't know how she does it. I really don't.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
She talks about how there's actually a hormonal change, you know, the nurturing hormones, the oxytocin, those start to wane. Like there's actually a scientific, like a physiological thing behind women waking up and becoming more feisty and finding their voices, and they stop caring about what people think and find themselves.
It's called testosterone. Yeah. It's like, I mean, we all have testosterone, but as the estrogen and progesterone start to wane, which are our kind mm-hmm. of, you know, our relief, particularly estrogen is the that's fine, darling, don't worry. You know, it's our nurturing, protective one. It's the one that makes us put up with shit in order to keep the family unit mm-hmm. together, even if that family unit is a couple unit. And to kind of not really mind so much about, you know, being seen as the second fiddle and all kinds of things. And as that starts to wane, you're like, hang on a minute, what about me? You know, and the effort, and you possibly you have sleep disturbances, you have less energy, you're having hot flashes, you know, your tolerance for bullshit really, really drops.
Yes, exactly.
and you know, that can be an incredible shock in a relationship. I mean, if I had been, you know, with a partner during that period, I can imagine it could have been very confusing for them seeing me change. You know, I'm partnered again now with someone that I met when I was 52, when I was, in a way for me, because my menopause was reasonably young, I was kind of through it. So, mm-hmm. you know, we've been together, you know, 7 years, and I haven't substantially changed my personality in that time. You kind of, you know, what you see is what you get. But I can imagine it could be really challenging to navigate that.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, coming back to the childless conversation and, you know, when you're 40s, you fit perimenopause, when your body starts to change, I don't know, this sounds woo-woo, but I'm a spiritual person. And I think that there is, you know, that our self-worth sits in the womb space and so can shame. Mm. And so we have it's like a perfect storm of shame as childless women, as single childless women, that it impacts our self-worth. And all of that is getting mixed up with all the stuff that is physiologically going on in the womb space during midlife. So it's like this big perfect storm of stuff that comes up for us, particularly as childless women, because of the shame that is invoked on us. And I want to get into that a little bit, because you talk about it in your book. And I think talking about it is what allows us to shed a lot of it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Brené Brown, or Saint Brené, as I think of her, is, you know, she says that empathy dissolves shame. You know, shame cannot survive the presence of empathy. And this is so true. And that also includes kind of giving ourselves empathy. Speaking out, you know, sharing our stories with other women and having them received, having them not find our stories shameful, you know, that absolutely transforms things, which is why, you know, podcasts like yours are so important, because, you know, there will be a woman listening to this, perhaps feeling deep shame about her aging female body, because the aging female body is a site of such shame in our culture. There is nothing to celebrate about it. You know, a man, when he gets older, becomes distinguished. a woman, when she gets older, just becomes shameful, you know. And now with this idea that there's this kind of pro-aging, that, you know, actually you can do aging in a really positive way, which actually means thin, white and rich, you know, let's be honest. And that's kind of like, well, that's like 90% of the planet, you know, written off. It gives us the idea that our body is a project and that we're fake.
Yes.
If you go to your anywhere in the world, even, you know, down to your local shopping center, anything, and you see such a variety of bodies, and yet we are fed this one idea, you know, of this, I'm sorry, this thin white yoga body. Mm-hmm. And now perfect gray hair, even. You've even got to do like beautiful silver hair.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, these ideas that there's always something wrong with your body. You've always something you've got to do about it. And something that really transformed my relationship with my body was when, and I'm someone who had a lot of eating disorders and body issues, you know, through my life. And I write about it in my book. When I stopped seeing my body as a project, and I started to see it as something to be incredibly grateful for. And I would do this exercise, which I write about in my book, which is called saying thank you. And I teach it in my work, and it's amazingly powerful and quite confronting, which is to get some body cream or just soap in the shower, whatever works for you, and go over each part of your body, touching it, maybe soaping it or putting some cream on, saying thank you. And find something to say thank you to each part for. So it might be starting at your toes. I say to my feet, thank you for enabling me to stand up and walk in the world. You know, I move up to my knees, you know, thank you for still enabling me to sit cross-legged, and I'm nearly 60. Not as long as I used to, but you're still doing it. You know, thank you to my bottom. You know, I have big hips and I have a generous bottom. It's always been my area of kind of like my least sort of the area I'm least happy with. And instead of thinking about it as something to be happy with or proud of, to be grateful for. Thank you for being so comfortable to sit on. You know, and as you do this exercise, you move right up through your body. And instead of thinking about what's not how it looks to someone else, really feeling how it feels to inhabit it. And if you have difficulty with a part of your body, and many of us do, imagine what it'd be like not to have that part. Or how difficult it must be for, you know, to have injuries and disabilities, if you're lucky enough not to have those right now. And it's a way of kind of coming home to ourselves and going, my body is not a capitalist project. It is not there to entertain the world by looking a certain way. It is the vehicle for my soul in this lifetime. I am so grateful to have a body. I could not be here without my darling body. And it's like, how do we come home with love and with empathy for the body we have? And that starts to transform our relationship with our body. And I have to say, it's actually a very radical exercise, because once you are in contact and in relationship with your body in a loving way, you discover the parts that are really difficult for you to love. So that's helpful too. But also it frees up an awful lot of energy so that you can do other things with that energy. You can start changing your life. You can start changing your relationships. You can start changing the world. You know, Naomi Wolf, she's not the world's most popular person anymore, but her book, Understand the Beauty Myth, you know, back in the 90s, it's really interesting how as westernization and capitalism reaches communities around the world, women start dieting and start getting, you know, eating disorders, because actually one of the best ways to limit women's autonomy that they have, you know, if they have political freedoms of any kind, if you can keep women worrying about the size of their ass, they're not going to worry about patriarchy and they're not going to change the world.
It's so true. And do you know what else I'm thinking about as you describe that exercise, Jody, is our sexuality and how shamed we, I mean, I can just imagine doing that exercise as a younger woman. And I don't know that I would have been able to do that without feeling some sort of shame about touching myself and touching my body.
Right.
And that is like, gosh, I bet you there's women out there who won't be able to do it for that reason, that it will take them a lot of practice to
just start with your feet
to cover it.
Just start with your feet. Don't have to do the whole thing. Just massage your feet and be grateful for your feet, and you know, there's no rush to complete this exercise. There's no one right way to do it. There's just your way to do it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I actually, because it's summertime and I'm out in my bare feet all the time, I always wash my feet before I go to bed. And I've started to almost ritualize it. And without really thinking about it, I just, there was just one day when I noticed how good it felt to wash my own feet and how, like, how nice it felt in bed afterwards. And like, it really changes something about you when you begin to notice what it feels like to be in your body.
And to cherish that.
Yes.
You know? It also releases, if you massage any part of your body with the intention of love and compassion, it releases a lot of oxytocin. So it actually releases a feel-good relaxation hormone that is released after orgasm. It's also released during breastfeeding, during birth, and also when cuddling a safe person. So it's a really, really powerful hormone, and you don't have to have a partner to access it. You can just massage your feet with the intention of, like, you know, really good feelings towards your feet and your body, and you will feel it. It will start after about 2 minutes. You will feel it in your nervous system.
This is an area that I never even expected to go on the podcast.
And by the way, I massage my feet every night before bed.
Oh yeah, I do too. It's, I mean, I also use essential oils. I'm such a, I have a bit of an obsession with them. And so that's something I rub oils into my feet after I wash them, and it's, it just feels so good. And it, yeah, it, because it releases that oxytocin. So changing the subject a little bit, because there's something I have in my notes here that I really wanted to talk to you about, and it's related. It's, you've talked in your book, on other podcasts, and I really want to bring more attention to it. The evolution of needing to fit in. I think that as childless women, and particularly as we age, we start to feel invisible. And we feel like we're excluded from the mom club. We're excluded, you know, as we age, from the young club. There's all kinds of ways that we begin to feel like we don't fit in. And you've talked about why it is so important for us to fit in and the evolution of that. And I want childless women to understand that it's not moms who make you feel excluded. There's actually an evolution behind this. So can you talk a bit about that? And also, well, okay, let me stop there and let you answer the question first.
I mean, fitting in is, you know, it's kind of a core need of human beings. You know, we are social animals. We are tribal. We are a tribal species. We operate in groups. And it is within groups that we find our safety. So, you know, we're not the dominant species on the planet because we can run the fastest or because we have the biggest claws. It's because we know how to cooperate in groups. You know, that is how we've become what we've become. When we realize we are not part of the in-group, we are actually part of the out-group, that is an intensely vulnerable feeling, particularly if you're also lonely. I mean, one of the reasons being lonely is so psychologically profoundly distressing is because our psyche makes it distressing for us in order that we will do something to find connection. Because it is within connection that we find safety. And we've been talking about, you know, growing older without children, begin to see how, if you do not have a group, a family group or a close social group around you as you age, you are more vulnerable than someone who has those intergenerational things in place. So it is, you know, we are programmed to find groups, yet we're also living in a culture which is hyper individualistic. And as childless women, many of us have also become hyper independent in order to cope and to survive. So it can be really hard. We may have lost the muscle, in a way, of how to find groups and be part of groups, how to maintain those connections. We may have lost the social skills, the give and take, the investment, the kind of the flow of energy that goes around a group. And it's absolutely crucial that it's kind of like a skill you have to learn. And even more importantly, as we age, we need to find, I call it alter kin. It's a phrase I created when I was part of AWOC, that's Aging Without Children in the UK. And it stands for Alternative Kinship Network. we need to find our alter kin, as our sort of LGBTQ, you know, brothers and sisters have been doing for many, many years. You have to find your own family. You have to create a family. You have to create a network. This is not something passive. This is something active. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to put the work in to create a group of people who will be around you as you age. And actually at all points in your life, because our need for groups never goes away, but the kind of group that we need often changes over time.
Yeah, that's really quite profound, actually, that there's this evolutionary drive, a psychological drive for the tribe. But it also, gosh, it makes me think of the last few years and the level of isolation that we have felt as a world community around the world.
And I think we're seeing some of the impact of that. I mean, people's ability to cooperate has really, really changed. I mean, I don't think people are talking yet, and perhaps we don't have enough distance on it yet to look at how profoundly human relationships have been impacted by what's happened.
Oh, yes, especially amongst the children and teenagers. Mm. And it has also highlighted how technology is wonderful and to some degree kept us connected, but it is not the same as being in person or being, you know, you and I both had to turn our videos off here. And I already feel like we are not as connected because we can't see each other.
Yeah.
It's not the same as having an in-person face-to-face connection.
Mm-hmm. It's not as nourishing.
No.
I mean, I was working on Zoom before the pandemic, before the world crashed my party. I've been working like quite a few years, you know, doing private sessions with clients and running groups. And I realized that that actually, for example, like when I used to do, I'm not in private practice at the moment, but I used to do therapy on Zoom. And I realized that the sessions were much, much more tiring for me than working face to face with a client. And after a while, I decided that what it was is that my eyes could see the person and hear them, but all of the unconscious communication, you know, their body language, their movement, their spatial position in the room, their smell, everything about them, and also the unconscious communications, the kind of my unconscious to their unconscious, all of that kind of stuff wasn't happening. But my brain, rather like a mobile phone that is looking for a tower, just kept sending that signal. It kept sending that signal, trying to connect to all those other levels of information, and it kept bouncing back empty. I was getting a lot from the work, and so were my clients, but I realized I had to work so much harder because they weren't in the room with me and our unconsciouses weren't together in the room. And it's very, very interesting what we gain, as you say, but what we lose as well. And I have to say, I think people have become quite nervous about face-to-face connection. And quite, not just because of, you know, possibly getting infected, but sort of getting de-skilled and also intolerant because, you know, in Zoom, everyone takes their turn. You know, there's a sense of kind of politeness. And then you get a kind of a live group of people in a room and they're all on different agendas and people, five conversations are going on or what have you. And as you say, with, you know, young people who maybe haven't had a chance to be socialized in the rough and tumble of real time conversation because they've lost a few years of schooling, can be really tough to work out how to operate in that because it's a skill.
Oh, yeah. Well, and for me, and maybe many others feel this way too, but it's almost like there's an energy thing that I want. Like I want that energetic connection of being in person. And yet when I go into the city, I live in a rural area. Mm. And when I go into the city and I get on the subway, the number of people and the energy around me, it's just almost overpowering for me. It's overwhelming. And I don't know whether it's just that I'm noticing, because I used to live in the city and I'd take the subway to work every single day. And I did. I mean, on the weekends, I felt like I needed to get out of the city. But when I go in, the few times that I go in now, just being around that sheer number of people, I mean, to me, I thought it was more of I'm more attuned to the energy of all of these people around me. But maybe there is an element of what you say in this de-skilling of, you know, my social skills and just being in that energy and that number of people and not knowing how to handle myself anymore. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I lived in London for 34 years. I was born there, but I grew up in the countryside. I moved back when I was 19. And then I moved to rural Ireland. And, you know, now my local town, which is 4,000 people, is that's urban enough for me. And but when I do go to London to see friends or for work or to family, you know, you feel what an extraordinary thing a big city is and what it takes to sort of thrive amongst that many people and to live and flow amongst that people. And it brings out a different part of me. And I think, like you, I think my energy has changed living very rural and very quiet. So it, mm-hmm. I think it would take me a bit of time to adjust to being back in the city. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's probably part of that too. And I think that's also happened with a lot of people who we've become more introverted as a culture.
Oh, totally.
It's not just a de-skilling. Our energy has changed mm-hmm. as a result of being isolated.
And it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out in the culture. I mean, Canada, I know, has a more introverted culture than the United States, but it's really been really interesting living in England over the last, you know, my life, because England went from, rather than Britain, but I specifically lived in England, went from being a quite introverted culture to being very influenced by American culture and getting more and more extroverted. And I think a little bit of introversion is a good balance.
I agree.
I think we need all of them. You know, you need the introverts in the room who are maybe processing things differently to the extroverts. When only the extrovert's point of view is welcome in an organization or a country or a culture, things don't go well.
Yeah. Yes. So bringing us back around.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at my notes because there were a couple of other things I wanted to get your thoughts on. Mm-hmm. And yeah. One of them was, and I just read this in your book, this was around letting go of the wounds. And I've been talking, in fact, I think just my last podcast episode that I published or two episodes ago was on this topic, letting go of the wounds, the poor me, I couldn't have children. And the safety of that sentiment in our pronatalist world.
Yeah.
The fact that we try to stay in that because it keeps us safe, and yet embracing a joyful life as a childless woman requires giving that up. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. It's a really bumpy transition. I remember very recently I was talking about this with a member of the online community who was kind of feeling kind of really ambivalent about starting to feel okay again. And I remember when that was happening to me, when I got the first glimmers of joy coming back, and I thought, oh, I wasn't expecting to ever kind of feel okay again about my childlessness and about my life. And I felt really ambivalent about it, because it's like, well, who will I be without, you know, my childless grief? You know, I felt that it was the most important thing anyone needed to know about me. You know, it's like, hello, Jodie, I'm childless. You know, it felt like felt like not just part of my identity, it felt like my identity. And I thought, well, if I can kind of come to terms with my childlessness and be at peace with it, does that mean I didn't really want children? It felt like a betrayal, kind of my longing for motherhood as well. And then I thought, but who will I be without it? Because I was becoming a new version of myself. I was someone who had made her peace with something that she never ever thought she would be able to make her peace with. So that was like a different person. And I didn't know who she was or what she would do with the rest of her life. One of the things I talk about is like using an analogy of pebbles. As we move into acceptance around our childlessness, it's not like a Disney acceptance. It's like, oh, great, I feel fine. It's like, right. You know, you don't wake up one day and like, I'm childless and it's great. Like, life's not like that. But it's, if you imagine two piles of pebbles, and on the left-hand side of pebbles, there's a kind of the parts of your childless experience you're really not okay with. And on the right-hand side is the pile where you've kind of accepted that that's how it is. And gradually over time, things will move from the not okay to the acceptance pile. And sometimes they'll actually move back. You know, they don't necessarily move over there and stay over there. But gradually over time, the pile of your kind of internal realities and conundrums and situations that is in acceptance, on the acceptance pile, gets significantly bigger than the parts that you're not accepting of. And you start to feel a big shift happening in yourself. And I say to people that that place of acceptance doesn't mean that your childlessness is okay. It doesn't mean that it's always, you're kind of happy about it or that it never happened. It just starts to be, it is what it is. You know, the energy of kind of fighting against it, of being angry about it, being sad about it, of being furious about it, needing to talk about it all the time, that energy starts to settle. And then that energy becomes available to your psyche to actually invest in new and different things going forward. And one of the really challenging things is you actually don't know what those are going to be. And mm-hmm. women have said to me, look, can you just tell me what my plan B is? And I'll just go and get on with it. Well, no, you know, lovely idea. Wish I had a crystal ball. Would have used it on myself first. But the fact is that, you know, no one else can know, and we can barely know ourselves what that will be, because the process of grief is a process of identity transformation. And we are becoming a different version of ourselves, maybe as different as from when we were 12 as to when we were 18. You know, it's a huge, massive transformation of our internal world. So we can't predict what that version of us is really what's going to light her fire. So it's really being patient, which is really hard for the ego. The ego just, I want the answers. I want them now. I want to know what training course I've got to go on. I want to know what I've got, you know, it's like, it really wants to jump to the solutions, but actually it's kind of going through that grief process, which grief is such a, people just think it's a terrible, it's not all about sadness. It's about rediscovering what lights your fire. When the thing that you thought would be the only thing that would light your fire is gone. It's such a big thing to do. And when we get to the point where we're starting to move into that new version of ourselves, there will be a wobbly time when we might want to take comfort in the idea that life done us wrong and it's not fair. And you know what?
Yeah.
That's true. That's true. And it's okay that that's true. We can still, you know, move forward as well. And moving forward doesn't mean that we leave. I mean, those children that live only in my heart, they're still in there. There is a precious place right at the core of my heart. There is a jewel in there, and they live in that jewel. And if I touch that place, which I'm touching now, it is very tender. But that is not all of who I am anymore. I don't want to lose that feeling inside me, because it's pure love. And love and grief are made of the same stuff.
And to bring it back around to self-worth, part of that acceptance is being okay with your path, accepting this new version of yourself. Mm. You need to build that self-worth, like to know that that new version of yourself is worthy in this world as well. That, totally. You know, in our world that tells us that it's not, that it's okay to love your childless life again.
Yes, it's okay to love your childless life. Absolutely. In a way, we have to disconnect our sense of worth from what society thinks, because we were born childless and worthy. You know, we get to keep that. Just because we didn't have children by choice or not, that does not mean we lose our sense of worthiness. Just because we're aging in a female body, we do not lose our sense of worthiness. It is only through the eyes of the culture, the pronatalist, patriarchal, sexist culture, that we have less value. We have to stop listening to them, and we have to listen to ourselves, and we have to find people around us who reflect our worthiness back to us. And we have to really mm-hmm. you know, choose who we spend our time with, what we do on social media, what we read, who we follow. You know, who gets to live in our head rent free? And if they are not doing a good job, mm-hmm. kick them out.
I love that saying, who gets to live in there rent free? We've got all kinds of people in there, really.
Yeah. Kick them out, say, I'm sorry, your tenancy is over.
I love it. So, and I would also add, going back to what you just said, our ageist culture, to bring back around that conversation.
Absolutely.
To be worthy as not just women who are croning, as you say, or aging, as women who don't have children, who are aging, you know, we have a place in society and we are worthy no matter what our ageist, pronatalist, patriarchal society tells us.
Absolutely. And those of us who have stepped out of that paradigm have incredible gifts of wisdom to offer younger women without children as well, to help, you know, lead the path to them to what I call it conscious childless elderhood. I don't think the world has ever been so in need of elders. I mean, we've had an explosion of older people. We have not had an explosion of elders. Youngers need elders as much as elders need youngers. And one of the things I'm really hoping I can do in the next sort of 10 years of my work is to really look about how we can create intergenerational connections to support younger people who are facing the most humongous challenges on the planet. Someone said, you know, older, you know, people without children have no skin in the game. You know, someone, even Elon Musk said that recently. I think that as someone who doesn't have children, my care for future generations is kind of for all of the future generations. I'm not trying to naturally take care of my children and my grandchildren's future. I'm not trying to protect anything. I can take risks. I can be bold. I can get out on the barricades and I can help organize. I have wisdom. I have ways to be of service to the world and to the next generation that are different to the ones that I'm, the priorities I might have had, you know, had I been a mother and grandmother. They are just as valuable and I can be just as much of service. And I think I can do it differently. And I love that there are so many of us now aging without children, women. I think we could become a force to be reckoned with. I think watch out patriarchy. I think there's a reason there's so many of us. We got your number and we're here.
It's so true. And I love that. I think that is a wonderful place to end. Before we do, where can people find you and what do you want them to do next?
So everything can be found on my website, which is gateway-women.com. If you're on Instagram, I'm at Gateway Women. And for the work around my elderhood work, you'll find me at Apprentice Crone. And that's very much connected to my Gateway Elder Women project, which is still kind of quite nascent. I'm very busy finishing a novel and building a house at the moment. So I haven't really had a chance to lean into that too much just yet. But, you know, the next part of my work, other than my novel, will be really starting to look at how to build local community, local intergenerational alternative kinship networks in our local communities. As you were saying, Sherry, it's actually about face-to-face. Online can take us a long way, but as we age and actually throughout our life, we need local friends who get us as well and who will be there for us when we need each other.
We do. And one thing that I want to draw my listeners' attention to, I didn't know about this until I listened to your podcast with Ruby Warrington, and you said, I forget what it's called, but your monthly meetings with the elder women.
Yes, it's called Fireside Wisdom with Childless Elder Women. And it happens quarterly. We do it on the solstices and the equinoxes. So we have one coming up. I don't know when this episode is going out, but we have one coming up on September the 15th, which we're doing for World Childless Week. And then we will have another one at the December equinox. And I bring together a group of older women without children from around the world in their sort of 50s, 60s, 70s, even 80s. And we chew over a topic each time. They are such good fun. I have to say they take my facilitation skills right to the edge, managing sometimes a quite rowdy, rumbustuous crowd of like 9 opinionated, brilliant, confident older women. Younger women really, really appreciate being in the company of these women, as do I. And older women finally can see themselves, older women without children, that, yeah, all the, I'm sorry, we're not these sad sacks sitting at home worrying about everything. You know, we're interesting women who've had interesting lives and are doing interesting things as we age, and are managing parents and their, you know, elderly parents and their issues, and are managing health issues of our own, and are dealing with aging, you know, as widows or single women, as well as, you know, partners. It's like aging is a rich mix. And I have to say, older women without children have got so much to say and so much to offer. You'll find the details for those on my website. Just click, go to gateway-women.com and click on Gateway Elder Women. You'll find all of the past episodes of Fireside Wisdom, and you can sign up for any future ones.
And something that you said to Ruby that I took to heart was, you don't have to be an elder to sit at the feet of your elders.
Absolutely.
And I loved that, because that just invited me in, even though I'm now 50, but at the time that I listened to that, I was 49. So I think I was, maybe I was already 50, but I still didn't think of myself as an elder.
And also, they are public. They are open. They're welcome. I mean, anyone could come along. You can come along if you have children. You can come along, you know, whatever your gender expression, whatever your age, they are open. They are free. And I just think what it would have been like for me as a young woman and as a middle-aged woman to have met women like that, to have heard them speaking frankly about the challenges and excitements and issues of growing older. I would have thought, okay, I want to be like that. I would have had something to look forward to.
Yes, I love it. Well, I hope that my listeners will take you up on that, because I think it's a wonderful opportunity. Yeah. And thank you so much. I will link everything that we've talked about up in the show notes, all the books, the podcast episodes, and your information, your contact information, Jodi. And thank you so much for another inspiring conversation.
Oh, Sherry, thank you so much. We covered so much, but I still think we only scratched the surface. We might have to write a book together or something. We've got so much to talk about.
Yes. I know. I feel like we could just go on and on. Thank you.